Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending. This is the first presentation of the Young Books lecture for 2013-2014. My name is Michael Shires. I'm the Collection Development Librarian here at the University of Regina. And today's session is titled, When a Director Dies, He Becomes a Photojournalist. The influence of Look magazine on Stanley Kubrick's career as a filmmaker. Our speaker today is Dr. Philippe Mather. He is an associate professor of media studies at Campion College, University of Regina. He's taught there since 1996. His doctoral dissertation is entitled Cognitive Estrangement Towards the Semiology of Science Fiction Film. His other areas of research include Orientalism and Cinema of Singapore, film music. Dr. Mather will talk about his newly published book by Intellect, titled Stanley Kubrick and Look Magazine, Authorship and Genre in Photojournalism and Film. From 1945 to 1950, Stanley Kubrick worked as a photojournalist for Look Magazine. Tracing the links between his photojournalism and films, Dr. Mather will discuss how Kubrick's employment at Look magazine fostered his emerging genius for combining images and words to tell a story. And there will be a reception afterwards. So please welcome Dr. Philippe Mather.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you everyone for coming. If you have any questions about the title, I can explain it later, because I realize I don't explain why I chose that title. In July of 1977, Arthur Rothstein, who's a famous photographer from the 1930s as part of the Farm Security Administration period, he wrote a letter to lawyer William Elwood about establishing the monetary value of Look magazine's unpublished photographs, which were donated to the Library of Congress in the fall of 1971 after the magazine ceased publication. Along with Henry Luce's Life magazine, Look had been America's most successful large format general interest photo magazine since 1937, and Rothstein was its photography department head for about 23 years. So Rothstein invited Elwood to, quote, note the large number of photographs by Stanley Kubrick, who has become one of the most famous film directors. These most certainly have considerable value, end quote. Rothstein was referring to over 10,000 photographs that were part of the images that had been donated to the Library of Congress. And these 10,000 had been taken between 1945 and 1950 by a teenage Kubrick, who'd been hired by Look as an apprentice in the spring of 1946, and by the end of that year was promoted to full member of the magazine's photographic staff. Of course, in hindsight, it's Rothstein's claim concerning the value of Kubrick's photographs may seem unsurprising, yet it wasn't until the mid-1990s that anyone showed a serious interest in them. So today I'd like to underscore an argument I made in my recently published book about Kubrick's career as a photojournalist regarding the significant impact of Look magazine on Kubrick's development as a visual storyteller. In light of new materials available at the Kubrick Archive in London at the University of the Arts, Elephant and Castle, I'd like to show that the reciprocal influence between photojournalism in film in the 1940s helps to explain why or how Kubrick came to master certain photographic and narrative skills and to develop particular thematic interests which initially gave his photojournalistic work a distinctive quality and then formed the basis for his work as a filmmaker. I'll also argue that throughout his career as a filmmaker, Kubrick consistently referred back to certain aspects of his photojournalistic work. And so to illustrate this, I will be comparing stills from Kubrick's better-known films with pages from back issues of Look magazine, some of which are on the tables in front of you, as well as photographic contact sheets from the Kubrick archive. While thematically and stylistically grounded in the dominant practices of post-war magazine journalism, the look photographs were revisited in various ways by Kubrick in his film productions, thereby indicating, in my view, an enduring influence rather than a mere technical apprenticeship. So, my first example is a snapshot of photojournalist Ouija, also known as Arthur Fellick, taken in July of 1947, on location in New York City during the filming of Jules Dassin's film The Naked City, loosely based, actually, Ouija's own photo book. According to Kubrick biographer Vincent Labruto, Ouija had been something of an idol for a teenage Kubrick and his neighbor, Marvin Traub, both fledgling shutterbugs who would spend afternoons in Marvin's darkroom. So for Kubrick to chronicle the photo essay production process by taking pictures of his colleagues at work on the same assignment as himself is in keeping with a growing interest in the post-war period in reflexive practices that point to a self-conscious, modernist style of discourse rather than an unheightened classical one. Kubrick was also photographed by his colleagues and made a number of self-portraits on the job. And in fact, 15 years later, he hired Ouija as a set photographer for his film Doctor Strange. Also, the fact that Look magazine was covering the production of a Hollywood film, Naked City, highlights the relationship between the magazines of the period and the magazine and film industries during the classical Hollywood period. A relationship that underscores the argument that intermedial processes are an ongoing rather than a periodic phenomenon, occurring only in times of change between media. And it helps to remind us, I think, that Kubrick's chosen medium of photojournalism can also be described as a singular combination of photography and film. And that Kubrick himself was hardly a lone artist who simply outgrew his interest in one medium and then switched to another. Just to quote from media scholars David Thorburn and Henry Jenkins, they've argued that, quote, the emergence of new media sets in motion a complicated, unpredictable process in which established and infant systems may coexist for an extended period, or in which older media may develop new functions and find new audiences as the emerging technology begins to occupy the cultural space of its ancestors. Moreover, in many cases, apparently competing media may strengthen or reinforce one another, revealing significant hybrid or collaborative forms that often emerge during times of media transition. So, in the case of the magazine photojournalism, this is a case in point, since the photo essay form, which was developed by publications such as Look, Life, Paris Match, National Geographic, and others, it represents a hybrid between documentary photography and narrative film. Photojournalism in such large format magazines was pulling away from spot news photography, which you'd find in newspapers, for example, and leaning towards the serial quality of comic strips and film storyboards, for that matter, partly as a strategy to compensate for the absence of movement in still photography and emulate cinema's narrative sequence of images and events. So my argument here is that the seeds of Kubrick's transition, you see, from photography or from photojournalism to film were already present in the unique photographic genre that he was practicing at Look magazine. And also he was, you know, not the the only staff member to show an interest in film or indeed pursue a career in filmmaking. Photo magazines were therefore broadly adopting film-like techniques such as serial photography, and in this case, as you can see, including phony sort of sprocket holes on the side of the images to suggest that length of film, cropping successive images to create a zoom-in effect, frames as well from specially modified motion picture cameras, basically the precursor to motor drives, particularly for their sports features. And in addition, magazine editors would tap into a popular fascination with the glamour of Hollywood by featuring profiles of movie stars. And Kubrick had several opportunities to photograph film celebrities such as Robert Montgomery, Doris Day, Jane Greer, Montgomery Clift, and the essay is here on the table. So to use Clift as an example, here's one unpublished image where he caught Clift, who was at the time the star of Howard Hawks' recently released film, Red River, and he was playing with the son of his actor friend, Kevin McCarthy. And so for this image, both the photographer and the actor are obviously crouched in order to help the reader identify with the boy's perspective. And Clift's expression here is meant to mirror Flip McCarthy's, thus bridging the gap between adult and child. And so this kind of imitative behavior also touches on a theme that Kubrick will revisit throughout his career, that of the other, right, as a double, either an actual twin, a sibling, or simply a reflection in a mirror, like the Brady sisters in the film The Shining. In Kubrick's first documentary, Day of the Fight, was an adaptation of his 1949 photo essay titled Prize Fighter, which is also on the table over here. And his second feature film, Killer's Kiss, made in 55, includes scenes borrowed from his previous boxing stories. So this visual and thematic focal point early in his career represents, I think, the clearest example of a direct link between his early projects. So Prize Fighter features the Cartier brothers from Greenwich Village, twins who live together as Vincent on the left here, was helping to train his brother Walter as a welterweight boxer. They're twins, but you know, obviously to tell them apart, obviously the one who's going to fight is the one who's having Vaseline applied on his face, right? To sort of deflect, I guess, punches of various kinds. Some of these pictures of the two of them look like they might involve trick photography, as if we were provided with two different angles on the same individual within a single frame. For example, this one, another unpublished photograph showing the twins playing chess, Kubrick's favorite game, was staged. And chess is interesting because it's a game, bless you, that's both similar to and different from boxing, in that it's nonviolent, but it also allegorizes life as a competition for survival. And in addition, in this case, the players look very much alike, implying that some of life's battles may be more about challenging oneself rather than defeating an external enemy. Moreover, the self-destructive potential inherent in trying to eliminate the other is made apparent in some of Kubrick's films, such as Fear and Desire, Killer's Kiss, and Full Metal Jacket, where the protagonist's victory is mitigated by the thought that he may have killed a part of himself in the process, or an alter ego rather than a radically different and hostile being. So for example, the two characters on the left here, this is from his first film, Fear and Desire, Corby and Fletcher, the actors playing this Lieutenant Corby and Private Fletcher, are also cast as the enemy general and his aide-de-camp, okay, so on the image on the right. So thus, by killing the two enemy officers, it may almost appear as if Corby and Fletcher, in a sense, killing themselves. Another series of unpublished photographs from the Walter Cartier job focuses on the fighter spending time at rest with his girlfriend, and some of the images at a roller skating rink are shot at ground level, so capturing the happy young couple in mid-stride. And others, including this one, adopt a more striking high-angle perspective in which the skaters are backlit, casting long shadows on the rink that fill the frame. So 22 years later, Kubrick films a visually similar scene for A Clockwork Orange in which the shadows cast by Droogs fall ominously on a homeless man lying under the bridge. So just going back to this image, shooting into the main source of light can also create a lens flare. So you see at the bottom of the image here, an optical artifact, right, visible as a ring of light. Now, by and large, lens flares fall under the category of sort of things that are considered undesirable defects of the image, both distracting and amateurish looking, which explains why lens manufacturers consider the reduction of these artifacts as a goal in improving lenses. Well, during Kubrick's career, the dominant photojournalistic and cinematographic practice was simply to avoid flaring the lens. Yet Kubrick would continue to do it, usually for dramatic effect or to create an authenticating sense of realism, one which Hollywood eventually adopted to a degree in the wake of the French New Wave and the documentary movement, their approach to filmmaking. So just I'll give you one example here. In Eyes Wide Shut, you have a fairly noticeable flare in the bottom left here, this sort of blue ring that appears in a scene between Tom Cruise and Faye Masterson. That's Sally in Eyes Wide Shut. It bears mentioning that Kubrick's willingness to experiment and within certain boundaries and break conventions is not unique, and that his colleagues at Look were certainly aware of artistic uses of photography, such as Alexei Brodovich's 1945 photo book titled Ballet. While the documentary norm was to produce easily readable images in sharp focus, the photo magazine dictum was always to entertain as well as inform, thus encouraging photographers to keep an eye out for striking or unusual compositions or effects. So much like mainstream filmmaking, the goal was to provide innovative material whenever possible within a familiar generic framework. So for example, at Look magazine, photographer Frank Baumann consistently explored the latest technology emerging at the time and became skilled at using strobe lights combined with multiple exposures, a technique that may indeed have impressed his young colleague Stanley Kubrick, who later experimented with strobe lights on 2001 A Space Odyssey. Motion blurs were also considered defects that could either compromise an image's readability or at least make it look unprofessional. Since photography initially established itself by emulating classical academic painting, blurring or even soft focus would have looked anomalous. With the rise of popular photography at the turn of the century, thanks to the wide availability of the Kodak Brownie, the difference between the sharp focus of sort of professional portrait photography and the sort of uncertain focus exemplified by the work of amateurs would have confirmed the impression that blurring was not ideal. So now this unpublished photo may thus have been considered particularly unsuccessful in that it contains both a lens flare on the top and a motion blur on the right side there in the top half as well. However, once again, not only was art photography's use of soft focus imagery in the pictorialist movement inspired by Impressionist paintings, but documentary photography itself was incorporating measured amounts of blurring as a sign of movement, spontaneous action, and authenticity, as in Robert Capa's famous action pictures on D-Day. So in Kubrick's snapshot, obviously the blurring of the door indicates that the doors are either opening or closing, and we can sort of speculate on what the character is doing. This woman on the right, for instance, is sort of she's adjusting her top and probably on the verge of walking outside, and so we can make those inferences based on these photographic defects. The woman on the left, by the way, was Kubrick's girlfriend at the time, soon wife-to-be, who sort of followed him around on some of these assignments, particularly the subway assignment. This is Life and Love on the New York Subway, which is on the tables here. It was published in March 1947, and this was his sort of graduating photo essay for during his apprenticeship period, and was published in March of 1947, as I said. And so Luke did, even though this image was left on the cutting room floor, Luke did publish images that included a small amount of blurring, provided that this was at the service of the photograph's narrative or other qualities. And it confirms that the magazine did not adopt a sort of a stringent rule regarding photographic defects, allowing other values to make up for an image's weaknesses, and perhaps even recognizing a positive reality effect that came from including such reflexive moments. So, for example, this is a playful interest in self-reference appears in many of Kubrick's assignments, such as the photo essay on the boxer Rocky Graziano, whose life was dramatized in the MGM film Somebody Up There Likes Me, released in 1956. So the magazine essay, titled He's a Good Boy Now, was published in a February 1950 issue of Look. And so this unpublished image features a partial reflection of Kubrick in the mirror. You can see him just above Graziano's shoulder here, where he bounces a flash off the ceiling to give the lighting a more natural look. So this contrasts with, for example, Ouija's street crime photography, which by necessity had to resort to harsh frontal lighting since it was outdoors and there were no ceilings to use as reflectors. So revealing the photographic apparatus, including artificial sources of light, can potentially distract from an image's message and a photo essay's narrative and argument. However, intermittent visual references to the photo essay mode of production could be integrated into a story involving, for example, in this case, a public personality whose time was partly spent being interviewed by the media. And so in the essay, quote, titled A Lady Lecturer Hits the Road, published in February 1950, look, a picture on the last spread shows the title character on the left here being photographed by a journalist from the Des Moines Tribune, reminding us that we're also looking through a camera lens, namely Kubrick's. Another convention that the narrative photo essay shared with film was to avoid showing the subjects looking at the camera, since the reader's pleasurable status as an anonymous voyeur might otherwise be compromised. Again, Luke would occasionally bend this rule by including one or two characters looking at the camera while the rest were minding their own business, introducing an element that would be read as humor or self-awareness as the photographer and the reader were briefly unmasked. So a good example is the first photograph from the third spread of Kubrick's subway assignment, this one here, published as Life and Love on the New York Subway in March 1947. So we see a man sitting on the bench across from Kubrick, smiling at the photographer, as the caption itself informs us that, quote, the wide-awake writer gives camera an I-know-what-you're-up-to grin. And Kubrick would include or revisit such moments in his film, The Shining, for instance, when Jack Nicholson looks at the camera angrily as he exits the caretaker's bedroom at the Overlook Hotel after having warned his wife not to interfere with his work. That's my impression of Jack Nicholson. A significant exception to the don't look at the camera rule would be formal portraits, provided there's no harm in suspending the narrative's forward momentum at a given point in a photo essay. So one strategy would be simply to begin a celebrity profile, for example, with a portrait, after which the story can then unfold uninterrupted. And it also helps to ensure that the portrait itself has some interest or some inherent visual interest beyond the sort of a standard medium close-up framing. So for example, these two unpublished images are posed photographs of the fighter Rocky Graziano in the center on the left and sitting in the passenger seat on the right, looking at the camera, engaged in an intriguing bit of mise-en-scene which remains unexplained. since these were never published, so there's no information about them. It just appears that Rocky and a group of men are shown wearing fur coats, bowler hats, and riding in a World War I era automobile. Of course, Graziano became a television comedian and film actor after retiring from boxing in 1952, so it may be that his interest in performance found an early outlet in Kubrick's photojournalistic assignment. The Monte Clift profile, for instance, includes this gag pose, slightly cropped version published photo essay, of Clift boozing on the floor, allegedly suggested by the actor himself, whose own real-life battle with alcoholism would lead to a premature death. Thus, Look magazine was not averse to including stage photographs if it could reveal something of a subject's personality and produce a memorable or otherwise entertaining picture, something which Kubrick would have benefited from. So the analyses of these photographic samples I've shown so far should begin the job of undermining the conventional assumptions regarding Kubrick's transition from photography or from photojournalism to film in the early 50s. The standard account is presented as an apparently straightforward, self-evident teleology whereby a young, talented photographer spends a few years learning how to use a still camera, then progresses to the more advanced medium of film, finally graduating to the most prestigious genre of the feature-length narrative fiction film. Instead of this sort of three-step process where each medium or genre is kept neatly separate from each other, we find a series of complex relationships between the photo essay or photo story genre and both documentary and fiction film. It's a form of intermediality in which narrative and rhetoric logic create a link between photography and film, allowing each medium to adapt the other's work, and where photojournalism specifically demonstrates a specific eagerness in developing print magazine equivalents to cinema's stylistic devices. The common mistake has been to assume that Kubrick simply took still photographs as if he were an art photographer, a mistake which photographic archives may unwittingly foster due to the fact that the magazine spreads are often not available to remind us of the image's original intended use. And it's an understandable oversight, given photojournalism's sort of low ranking on the art scale, and the desire to engage in curatorial exercises, such as exhibitions and art books and so on, that take advantage of dominant values in Western aesthetics. Unfortunately, recontextualizing Kubrick's work after the fact in this fashion is not only ahistorical and myopic, it may also limit access to the or knowledge of the Look magazine photo essays and thus compromise our growing understanding of Kubrickian narrative aesthetics, particularly their origin. A related matter that the Kubrick archive may shed light on concerns the production of promotional materials such as advertisements and publicity stills, activities that Kubrick was always personally involved in, which simultaneously contributes to the myth of the total auteur, but also contradicts some romantic notions of art for art's sake. And this is relevant to his training as a photojournalist, since magazine photo essays often, as these examples indicate, often shared sort of two-page spread real estate with advertisements. Moreover, Look was an industry leader in conducting Gallup polls. In fact, they invented the Gallup poll as part of their market research to determine what readers were interested in seeing in their magazines, including young women on the covers and babies and pets inside. So Kubrick would have been made aware, acutely aware, of the medium's marketing tropes based on their demonstrated success in reaching millions of magazine readers with each issue, a knowledge that he would apply to his career in filmmaking. For example, even though Kubrick's debut feature, Fear and Desire, was an allegorical war film, sort of an attempt to make an art film, the posters promoting the film included the line, "The wolves are breathless about Virginia Leith," referring to the actress who played a brief non-speaking part, describing her also as a strange half-animal girl. And Kubrick himself took the publicity stills of Leith wearing a sort of a satin breastband, in a scene not featured in the film at all. A similar approach was adopted for the publicity stills produced for Kubrick's third feature, The Killing, made in 1956, including several images representing scenes that are not present in the film. So it may be that these were deleted scenes or that the images were simply staged to enhance the film's sensationalism. So for example, The Killing never dramatizes a relationship between Sherry, Marie Windsor, and Johnny, Sterling Hayden, even though Sherry does try to flirt her way out of a tight spot when she's caught spying and later lies to her husband, George, about having been taken advantage of by Johnny. Such departures from a film's released versions were also a common feature in movie story magazines, publications devoted to fictionalizations of feature films. And Kubrick would likely have been aware of these practices. And of course, publicity stills also fed the film buff's desire for movie stars and investment in the star system. So in this image, Hayden and Windsor are not only performing an alternate storyline for The Killing as Johnny and Sherry, they're also fulfilling their function as glamorous, well, or somewhat glamorous movie stars, always available to create a fantasy of heterosexual romance for the benefit of their fans, regardless of the actual roles they play. Another significant item from the Kubrick archive is a partial collection of back issues of Look magazine itself, specifically those in which Kubrick's work was published. So the collection includes 21 photo essays removed from the original issues, as well as 12 complete issues, currently on loan to the traveling Kubrick exhibition at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So I think that the fact that Kubrick kept or bothered to keep these old magazines is, to me, compelling evidence that he didn't try to somehow repress or deny this formative period in his professional life, and that he, in fact, valued the work he accomplished in New York. So the most obvious link between film and the photo essay is narrative. Single photographs, of course, can have narrative features, but they cannot compete with the storytelling potential of an impact of dozens of photographs printed in various sizes, in elaborate two-page layouts, measuring 21 inches by 13 and a half, accompanied by editorial text and picture captions. So given the narrative concerns, that narrative concerns are a key aspect of Kubrick's filmic oeuvre, ignoring the photojournalistic influence represents an important methodological oversight. So from a stylistic perspective, photography and film share issues of framing and mise-en-scène, with the notable exception of acting. Otherwise, the photo essay form in the late 40s consistently strove to find formal equivalences to the most significant differences between photography and film, namely sound and movement. What I'd like to do is to show you just a few examples that illustrate Kubrick's ability to transfer his skills, in effect, as a photographer to the film medium. The Walter Karchi photo story begins in the middle of things with a full-page, sort of soulful portrait of the boxer waiting patiently with his trainer for the summons to the ring. And so this is followed on the next page, of course reading left to right, top bottom, by a flashback to the morning of the same day as Walter wakes up with his twin brother, Vincent. The flashback, of course, is a standard device narrative device that can effectively direct the reader's attention to the events which led to the introductory teaser. Kubrick would avail himself of that flashback structure in The Killer's Kiss, The Killing, Lolita, with a murder of sorts, in each case linked to the flashback. The second page of Prizefighter continues with a montage, so basically the images on the right there, a montage of images depicting the boxers' preparations on the day of the fight, including breakfast, the weigh-in, the physical exam, waiting for a ride to the arena, and on the left, praying in church. Such descriptive summaries of montage sequences of the protagonist's habitual activities is a common feature of the photo essay and serves both didactic and narrative functions. In this case, the images help the reader to appreciate the methodical quality of Cartier's preparation, to identify with the main character, and build tension leading up to the main event. Similarly, Kubrick's documentary film version of the Walter Cartier story called Day of the Fight would include montage sequences chronicling the training routine with such images as Walter being given a rub down by his and having his hands taped by his brother. Virtually identical scenes appear in Kubrick's second feature film, Killer's Kiss, when the boxer in that story, Danny Gordon, is prepared by his trainer. And I might add that the training of the gladiators in Spartacus, a film which he did not initiate but directed, and the soldiers in Full Metal Jacket also use a photojournalistic kind of montage sequence to convey the rigor and physicality of the work involved. Holiday in Portugal, which is also here on the tables, was published in August of 1948 and was Kubrick's major travel essay, and the one time he was sent abroad on assignment. So this image here is the second spread's left page, and it exemplifies the two main strategies employed by those editors for this assignment. So the top half of the page is composed somewhat like a family photo album of American tourists in Lisbon, helping Look subscribers to identify with the couple's travels. And then the bottom half offers a kind of an aestheticized documentary record of the, quote, ancient Portuguese fishing village of Nazaré, portrayed as both timeless and exotic. So the photo album may be a variation on the montage sequence in that it offers literal snapshots of various locations visited by the travelers. And similarly, the narratives of Kubrick's films often adopt an episodic structure meant to illustrate significant moments in the protagonist's journey. So for example, the picaresque and violent adventures of Alex in A Clockwork Orange and Redmond Barry in Barry Lyndon may be considered film versions of the travel photo album, especially when the episodes are brief, and aided by a voiceover narration that supplies information that would be included as captions, in a photo essay such as The Holiday in Portugal. In addition, Kubrickian heroes often find themselves at odds with their environment, typically conveyed through wide shots of characters overwhelmed by their surroundings. In the Portugal assignment, this quality is expressed by highly formalized compositions that sharply separate visual planes, making it appear as if the cooks, the travelers, were not really in Lisbon and that their likenesses were sort of cut and pasted into the photographs. As for the representation of villagers of Nazaré, they tap into sort of romantic notions of primitivism, even though Kubrick himself has written against the concept of the noble savage. Nonetheless, from a pictorial perspective, Kubrick did initially engage in the kind of idealized representation of traditional communities that called upon certain photographic techniques to beautify or ennoble the subjects, techniques that he was able to apply and so demonstrate his skill. So for example, his second documentary, Flying Padre, includes close-up portraits of sort of senior parishioners from the town of Gallegos in New Mexico that could have been lifted from his Portugal assignment. And his first feature film, Fear and Desire, includes his first wife, Toba Metz, on the left, whom we saw earlier in the subway, as one of the three fisherwomen knee-deep in the river of an unnamed foreign country. So in light of our emerging knowledge about Kubrick's training at Look magazine, and the work he accomplished in the 40s, I think it becomes easier to examine his better-known films through a photographic or photojournalistic filter in order to identify moments in the films that reveal a photographic sensibility and thus to evaluate the extent of Look's influence on his identity as a visual storyteller. One visual trope that captures a defining characteristic of the photo essay is multiple frames within frames, including inset photographs, windows, and mirrors. Indeed, the photo magazine's two-page spread has been defined by Arthur Rothstein as the basic unit of design in a photo essay, which normally includes several rectangular photographs of various sizes, printed in landscape or portrait formats, with each page dominated by larger pictures. The photographs are also underlined by captions and separated from each other by interior margins, as well as body copy, that is the editorial text. So this montage of photographs and text has been compared to film storyboards and has the virtue of highlighting formal similarities and differences spatially rather than temporally, right, in contrast with film. However, the film does have the option of including several elements within the same frame, thus creating its own version of the magazine spread. So, for example, this clever composition in Kubrick's second film, Killer's Kiss, shows the protagonist, Davy, answering a call from his uncle George in his apartment. So, if we think of this image as a two-page spread, on page right, the image, sort of a full frame or a full page picture of Davy faces the camera and promising to visit his uncle's farm in Seattle. And meanwhile, his reflection in the mirror, which you see as an outline just in the middle of the image, reveals his actual eagerness to ogle his attractive neighbor, Gloria, on the left side of the image, seen through two sets of windows, which may remind us, for example, of James Stewart observing Miss Torso in Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window in 1954, so around the same time. Also, the mirror's frame on the extreme left is lined with family photos, including a farmhouse and two cows, further multiplying the number of frames within frames and creating a kind of magazine spread. So the protagonist's rural background is revealed, and also contained within these these small size snapshots in the window in the middle, Davy's potential object of desire is sort of imprisoned as she appears to be behind the window bars. The use of inset photographs in Kubrick's later films, such as The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut as well, tap into photography's cultural associations with stillness, entrapment, and death. And finally, of course, mirrors themselves represent both the self-conscious play on appearances, on the lack of reality of film images, and the aforementioned theme of the double, usually linked in Kubrick's films to the main character's struggle between reason and emotion, a duality that can be mapped onto the photojournalistic battle between images and words. So, in conclusion, I've argued that Stanley Kubrick's indebtedness to his tenure as a photojournalist in the late 40s, during formative years in the lifespan, as far as he is concerned, he's about 17 to 21 years of age, this is underscored by the presence of back issues of Look magazine in his personal archive, and most tellingly, I think, by the mutually compatible qualities of the photo essay in film media. So one can thus recognize filmic leanings in post-war photo magazine aesthetics that would have provided Kubrick with transferable skills when he began making films at the end of his career at Look. And Kubrick had clearly internalized Look magazine's commitment to personal journalism, meaning requiring a character-centered narrative Moreover, Look's explicit goal was always, as I mentioned earlier, to inform and entertain its readership, which encouraged the editors to adopt a balanced approach between convention and innovation, and also between candid and staged imagery. So Kubrick's films would reveal an enduring sort of adhesion to documentary techniques such as sharp focus and deep space, as well as certain thematic tropes such as the double, marital infidelity, and sport as allegory. It has also been pointed out that recognizing the value of this comparative analysis between media must overcome ongoing prejudices suffered by photojournalism, as articulated by scholar Wendy Kozol, writing about Life magazine. Quote, Life took the photographic language of documentary and refined it into a more commercial language of journalism, photojournalism, in which advertising and editorial content complemented each other. As a result, photo historians have often dismissed photojournalism as a commercial and therefore debased version of documentary, end quote. So it should be clear that such an evaluative stance is a barrier to a productive analysis of Kubrick's discourse in this case, particularly when we consider his professional approach to designing advertisements, including their integration into his own films, often in the form of creative and illuminating product placements that also contribute to a story's realist tone. So, speaking of realism, Kubrick's terse expression, real is good, interesting is better, which was actually borrowed from the famous theater director Konstantin Stanislavski, is misleading, I think, to the extent that it implies a predominantly surreal or non-realist aesthetic, when the exact opposite, in my view, is in fact the case. Indeed, Kubrick also often expressed a phobia for anything that might be perceived as phony, and a commensurate desire to ground all of his flights of fancy with a documentary-like attention to detail, primarily as a means to ensure the audience's ability to identify with and believe the fictional world. That's all. Thank you. Establish some more far-fetched than others, obviously, but generally across all of his films, one can, as I mentioned in my talk, apply the documentary approach of deep focus, sharp focus, deep space, and attention to detail, and certainly, he made as much research on 2001 or The Shining as any of his other, like his Barry Lyndon. And so he's always, in fact, he was perhaps even more concerned with the documentary realism of his fantasy films than he was, the naturalistic films. Out of a concern, as I mentioned, that he was very keenly wanted his audience to, just believe the reality, if you like, of those, fantasy stories. He even considered, for example, including a documentary prologue to 2001, A Space Odyssey, with interviewing different scientists and philosophers on the plausibility of the existence of, life off the Earth. And, happily for us, he chose not to do that, but, it indicates that he was very concerned with that. And one example I alluded to but didn't talk about was, in sort of visual terms, his commitment to, sharp focus and space. At one point, he asked one of his cinematographers, Douglas Trumbull, better known as a special effects artist, to sort of look into photographing the model shots, those for the, you know, the outer space photography sequences, to use strobe lighting. The idea being to produce as sharp and as deep, you know, images as possible for those sequences, and make them as realistic looking. And of course, what they did a few tests, but then they realized that while the images were indeed extremely sharp and deep, they realized that in terms of film, it worked against it because it produced a strobe effect, you know, similar to stop motion animation. If you've seen examples of, you know, where there's a kind of a strobe, sort of stop motion quality to precisely to that imagery. But I think it's another indication of his enduring kind of commitment to photographic, you know, realism, and also, you know, again, also affecting the kind of research he did, because I've been a witness to Look magazine's methods of doing research, and as you can imagine, I mean, doing 10 times more research than would be necessary just to satisfy a magazine's legal department, for example, you know, and so that certainly showed it throughout his career, you know, producing an insane amount of research for Napoleon, which he ended up shooting in the end, for example, with an incredible card catalog. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of that, where he developed, with some research assistants, unbelievably detailed card catalog with each card indicating what representing each day in Napoleon's life, so that he could track exactly, you know, and cross-referenced and everything. So he was borderline insane in terms of the amount of research. But, you know, again, I think it speaks to his desire to, and it's not just realism for the sake of realism. He felt that it was kind of a groundwork, you know. Once he had that established, hopefully his hope was that he could then, you know, touch his audience's mind and emotions as well, you know, just by establishing that kind of believability quotient at the outset.
Can I take the bait and ask about the context of the quote that you used for the lecture? I might have missed the explanation.
Oh, yeah. Right. So basically, Kubrick referred to this quote himself when a director dies. Maybe I'll just go to the. Yeah. The original quote was, when a director dies, he becomes a photographer. And so this is attributed to John Grierson, who had, in the 30s, had written critically about Joseph von Sternberg's films, finding them much too attractive visually and kind of empty in terms of their storyline. So Kubrick criticized this proverb or this saying, you know, finding it a bit glib and, you know, just kind of clever, but not very informative. In a way, I guess it works against my argument, because I'm suggesting that photojournalism is very important. But I used it just to, you know, just to get us thinking about or just to remind us that he was not an art photographer, but rather a photojournalist. And something that you might, you know, one might not get that impression based on, you know, other information that's out there on Kubrick's, you know, background as a photographer. I think one will see in the coming years a tendency to want to highlight almost to recreate his identity as an art photographer rather than a Look magazine photojournalist, you know, for reasons that, as I tried to explain, have to do with, you know how photojournalism is ranked, you know, in public perception, and the ease with which, I mean, it ends up being more of a commercial venture. You know, it's more easy to make money out of art photography than photojournalism. So, you know, for the estate, and I don't want to speak that poorly or badly of the estate, but, you know, understandably, they would be more interested in leaning in that direction, presenting him, recontextualizing his work in a certain way. And so I was just pointing out that it's it could be, you know, from a scientific perspective, we might lose out, and you know, if we kind of forget that his actual origin, because it's all about storytelling. It's not simply about individual art, you know, art photography.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. In his later films, then, would he have used photography as a kind of a research tool, or did he just
Oh yeah, no, I think it was always there. I mean, for instance, well, his later film, I guess, I mean, for instance, on 2001, he would take Polaroids to check the lighting, you know, that sort of thing. But, I mean, thematically, The Shining is probably the clearest example of a film that fully integrates photography in film.
Yeah.
I mean, because it, you know, it ends with a close-up of a photograph. Bless you. You know, and which, and so it's a perfect illustration of that cultural perception of photography as realistic and film as illusion.
Yeah.
You know, and of the association of photography with death. I mean, Nicholson's character is obviously dead, he's frozen, you know, and then you show him in this photograph. And a film with life, even though that life is an illusion, because we realize that, oh, film is just made up of still photographs, actually. So, yeah, so I think it, you know, and Eyes Wide Shut has another scene where he goes to meet up, Tom Cruise's character meets up with his old, you know, his college buddy who plays the piano, and so he sees his photograph outside the cafe entrance, you know, and so there's a kind of a foreshadowing there of his death or mistreatment. I mean, he's not killed, but, you know, so, yeah, it's, I think, carries on. You can trace it through all his films.
That's fascinating.
As with other lectures, this is being recorded and will be available on our space, the university's online repository. So if you've missed anything, you want to listen to it, that will be available in the near future. Thank you again. There is coffee just outside the minute.